Yeah, he's our favorite nerd. Bringing you news and knowledge from the world of computers and technology, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
We've got plenty in store for you this week here on Computer Talk Radio. Let me go through some of the things we've got going on. Keith McIntyre and I are going to talk about some crazy clients. Marty, he says meetings are mind-numbing, and he provides some statistics to back that up. Steve Keske, well, we've got more discussion in regards to radar on the IT Pro Series Burnout. I'm going to continue. I've got a short series on this, and I'm going to tell you this week why IT professionals are at a greater risk for burnout. On the scam series, the I changed my number scam. I've got a number of listener questions. David asks, will VR and AR ever make it and work in the business world? Sarah asks, how do we reconcile AI growth with a belief in God? And Sam asks, sub for sub, is this a good replacement for organic social media growth? And I'm going to talk to that one. All of that, of course, on this week's Computer Talk Radio. If you miss any of this, go to the podcast at computertalkradio.com. You can also reach me there, or you can phone me at 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. I'm more than happy to answer your computer questions, your technology concerns. And along with that, we also provide the news. And let's start off with, well, okay, TikTok. And there's an obligatory TikTok update. And they had a quick outage. It lasted, I think it was under a day, with a restoration that praised the incoming U.S. president. Now, I stay mostly away from politics along through this show. So the president did say he planned to give more time for the Chinese-based social media platform to find a new buyer. All the way along, it really feels like a marketing stunt more than anything else. They, you know, in the closing days of the previous presidency, they said, it's all horrible. We're going to have to shut down. We're going to have to shut down. We're going to have to shut down. They shut down. And then a day later, oh, hey, the new guy, hey, he's going to save us. Okay. Other platforms did benefit during that outage, but it raised more questions as to if they are no different than any of the other platforms, than any of the other complaints in regards to TikTok. So this ongoing drama is going to continue as lawmakers use their own platforms to either support or decry the usage of TikTok and all of this ongoing issue. Netflix. Well, okay, so this has been an ongoing thing, and it's not really much of a surprise that as Netflix broke 300 million worldwide viewers, that they would go ahead and, yeah, raise their prices, their rates again. No surprise. They added 19 million new subscribers in the last few months, and that is a new single quarter record for them. At this rate, it's not likely to slow down anytime soon. They are a great resource for all kinds of streaming video. And they've been on top of the streaming game for so long that it just seems like a given that they're going to just keep continuing no matter what they do, raising their rates at whatever level. For years, this has been a matter of a couple of bucks at a time, and this isn't any different, really. Your next billing cycle, if you're with Netflix, is going to bump up a couple more dollars. The new numbers, $25, $18, or $8, depending on your tier with Netflix. There is an extra viewer option that they introduced, what was it, a year ago, 2 years ago, whatever it is. That's also going to go up by a dollar a month as well. Now, just as I mentioned last week about a hotel reservation can differ as to where you live, where you're setting that from. They did a comparison between a number of different cities. Phoenix was one of them and the San Francisco Bay Area. And if you did a hotel reservation off in New York, it could be as much as $500 more just based on you living in San Francisco or you living in Phoenix, Arizona. Wild numbers. Anyways, just as that can happen, the Federal Trade Commission put out a report that many retailers are doing a wide variety of checks against who you are to pitch you different products or even different pricing. They're referring to this tactic as surveillance pricing, and it's working in many different directions against us, the consumers. The data tracked is specifically set up to impact and improve profits across the board for all sellers of all manner of different products. So this is no different than Netflix, Meta, and all of their algorithms and algorithm-driven companies. And this is all where that's designed to serve up content and advertising to you. This is part of big data, and it's going to continue more and more unabated and, for the most part, hidden through all of our lives. Yes, the FTC is opening up a comment period. Yes, they may try to put their finger in the, you know, into the pie and say, you can't do that, you can't do this. But I think people are going to continue on doing business as normal, and they're going to, for the most part, ignore the Federal Trade Commission. Apple AirTags are a nice, inexpensive tool, and I use them for tracking my key backpacks and even my cat. Arvada, Colorado police have decided they wish to work to prevent auto theft through that same method. So what are they doing? They're giving away free AirTags and tile trackers to the residents of their city and a sticker. And this sticker, they want you to put it on your car. And the hope here is that if your car is stolen, that you will share that AirTag tracker information, which will allow the car to be located quickly. It just has to be within a certain distance of an iPhone for a brief moment for that information to be passed along. Same thing over on the tile trackers and the Android side. This is actually far cheaper than some of the various other GPS tracking options that we've seen over the years. I'm thinking of, I'm struggling with the name, LoJack. There we go. And so it's not going to eliminate threats, or thefts, rather. I don't see it doing that, but I think it may help to bring some of those bad guys to justice. It may level some of that playing field and perhaps restore more cars back to their original owners. Bamboo Lab. So these guys are a 3D printer manufacturer and a little bit more than that, as I'll explain here in a moment. They have announced that if you want to continue to use your 3D printer, that you have to use their software in the information that you're sending over to the printer. Now, this is basically an industry where usually you would design your 3D printed object in one program, like a CAD software or a junior version of a CAD software. And then you would send it through a slicer, which would say, okay, each of the individual slices get stacked one on top of another to generate your 3D printed object. And then it goes over to the printer. So Bamboo Labs wants to eliminate that slicer, and they want to control a lot of that information all the way through. Now, the interesting thing is they already can tell if you are using their own filament or not. So there is a fear that's being voiced by a number of different users of Bamboo Lab printers in that Bamboo Labs may someday follow the idea of HP and lock you down to what may eventually be their paid software, their material, their own methods and designs and whatever else along the way, rather than you to simply use the hardware and create to your heart's content. While Bamboo Labs is initially pushing back, saying they have no intention of doing anything like that, it's clear that we are again moving towards that world where what you own may not really be yours. Closing out the news, 35 years ago, the first ransomware was distributed. It wasn't via methods we think of today, not via the internet or anything like that. It was DARPANET or ARPANET way back in those days. But This was distributed via 5 1/4 inch floppy disk sent out to PC Business World magazine subscribers, as well as a few other locations. It was developed by a doctor, a biologist, and these were also sent out to other locations to the tune of about 20,000 disks. It purported to contain information in regards to the disease called AIDS, but instead infected computers all over. It was somewhere in the first 1,000 malware packages and ranked as a Trojan. So it wasn't self-propagating, but that was the only thing that limited its overall impact. There were other oddities along the way. The doctor, well, he was the most odd. He was determined later to be mentally unfit to stand trial with many wild courtroom antics. Coming up next, I'm going to explain the value of technology products and what to buy. That'll be next here on Computer Talk Radio.
Let's talk about on and off.
You mean like light switches?
Yeah, the original user interface device.
And you were there, right?
Hey, I'm not that old.
Yeah, you are. So on and off.
Yeah, only with no humans doing it, like...
But you and I both have our computers on CyberPower UPS systems.
Yeah, so we have power, but there's another on and off.
Oh, right. Online and offline.
You got it. Meaning another UPS at the cable modem and VoIP phone and Wi-Fi router.
And even a low-cost standby UPS can handle those. Better, of course, if it has AVR.
Right, so it doesn't have to hit the battery just because the line voltage drops.
Maybe it's a good time to mention the promo that saves $10 to $15. Details are at the CyberPower website.
And maybe you could put it on your website?
Oh, that's already done at ComputerTalkRadio.com.
You know, on and off. You take really good care of your listeners.
The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That's how you can reach out to me. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will give you assistance with your computer problems, your tech concerns, whatever they may be. Now, I want to talk about value, and I'm not talking about you have to get the expensive brands, and I'm not talking about there is some value that sits in premium brands. I'm thinking Apple, and I'm thinking Samsung as far as those phones, and that is actually a little bit different there. But I also want to make sure that you do not get generic when you need something more. So let me break up technology into four categories. We have the cheap, the tolerable, the middle, and the premium. And the cheap, look, we all understand cheap. This is the no-name, odd name. There are instructions that are barely in English. This is the burger off the rack at the local truck stop. It's 3 years old, and all it does is provide sustenance. Then we move on to the tolerable. This is the brand that's a house brand. It's like Best Buy's Insignia, or Walmart just recently bought Vizio. It has some merits, but most are based in the pricing. This is like McDonald's or some other chain. It's formulaic. It's food, but it's not so much interesting. And tech follows along with this all the way. The middle of the road. These are the brands that are available everywhere from Best Buy to Micro Center to Amazon and beyond all of that. If you can find the brand in multiple stores and it's got some recognition, then yes, we're talking about the middle of the road. This is your Red Robin, your Chili's, or some other sit-down burger chain. Last up is that premium. All right, Sony, Apple, other brands rely on their name recognition, and Samsung's there, and they have a price boost that's based in their name alone. Sure, there are some merits to some Apple products, and there are some that deliver value, but I'm not talking so much about this right now. The premium burger just is that parallel I've been working with. It includes like a truffle sauce, truffle oil over it. It's maybe got some portobello mushrooms on it or whatever it is. Something that will tantalize the taste buds or even experience. It's something that is off the beaten path. It's a custom burger, and it is delicious. So let's piece these apart a little bit more in that tech realm. All right, the cheap. I don't suggest cheap for anything but a one-time situation or specialty situations where the functionality is so simple that anyone can do this. I do not suggest this for televisions or daily usage items, but perhaps, maybe if you've got a lot of smart light switches, maybe go down that road. Then we move into the tolerable. And I suggest the tolerable for spare rooms, for the people who need occasional tech, or people who are on a bare bones budget. Now, I'll get into budget a little bit later, but what I'm thinking of here is reminiscent of the Hyundai cars from the 1980s. They were functional, but they were not for most consumers. Now, Hyundai has built up a better reputation over the years, and they have actually moved into that next level of middle of the road. And you've got to weigh this out. You've got to think about, am I buying that cheap bottom of the line car? It doesn't have air conditioning. It doesn't have any power windows, power door locks, power seats. It's all manual everything. Okay, it's functional, but most people aren't going to buy tech in that realm. Next up is the medium. And most products in tech sit here. This is your Ford, your Chevy, and even across the lines, Toyota and Honda and so forth. These are the cars that you see on a daily basis. The tech from places like LG, whose humble beginnings match up with Hyundai, or Samsung, or Apple's iOS series of devices. These are, yes, right there in that middle realm. And then we move into the premium. And we all know Apple has premium items. They've got items where, yeah, you're paying a big chunk of change. Samsung, too. I'm not singling them out by any means. These are the Rolls Royces, the Bentleys, Ferraris, Lamborghinis of the car world. But across the board, this also includes some names that you haven't heard of. There are headphone names out there that they start in the $500 to $1,000 range and go up from there. That's just an example. And those boutique names set a certain level of premium. So now I've covered these, but I want to talk about purchasing for your best value. So a couple of years ago, a friend came to me with a request for info on television for usage as a monitor, just like I've done now for probably 5 years or more that I've done this. And I spec'd out the same one that I have right now, a 4G LG, a 4K LG TV that at 43 inches, it doubles as a very decent monitor. And I went through a lot of work to determine which one to choose amongst their brand and a number of other brands. Now, this friend called me from the store. He was asking about ways to save money on the deal. Now, I get it. We all want to save cash, but this wasn't the place to do it. The need for using this as a monitor were baked into the tech of the specific television chosen. Now, we have this idea in our minds that somehow we can save money by going to cheaper versions, but frequently in tech, it is a false economy that this is built on. In the friend's case, he was hoping to save a matter of $25 on his whole purchase, but that would have been built on lesser specs that would have frustrated him far more. And I've had people come to me and, hey, I want to purchase a laptop. Great. This is what you should consider spending. And they said, no, I can buy one for cheaper than that. And I've had to tell people, your price point is too low. All right. So let me give you kind of a quick, easy guideline. Your price point for a laptop should be somewhere around 2% of your annual salary at a minimum. 2% of your annual salary. So if you make $100,000 a year, yeah, that's $2,000. If you make $50,000 a year, yes, spend $1,000. You want to budget that up. You want to make sure you've got that money that's coming along there. Why? Because lesser ones are not going to last as long or be as durable. You're going to wind up coming back and making that purchase again soon thereafter. I had a friend that reached out to me. He wanted to get a laptop. He had mentioned that he was a CEO of a company that made a Mint. And I knew what kind of car he drove. It was a very nice, expensive car. And I had to say, look, what are you doing here? You're looking at a $500 laptop when you can afford a $5,000 laptop. Now, I'm not going to suggest that you buy the $5,000 laptop, but you do need to think about what you can afford as a portion of your overall income, your overall net worth. So, you know, I had to tell him, you don't drive an entry-level car that just moves your body. Why would you purchase an entry-level laptop to move your bits and bytes, your data? That is not good. And there are other things out there, and you can weigh this in. If it's a simple throwaway laptop for really basic things, maybe go lower. If you're using this day in, day out, yeah, you're going to go up further. There are sweet spots for the pricing of laptops, computers, and tech of all kinds. Do not skimp and save on the silly things. If your life isn't generic everything, then your tech shouldn't succumb to that idea. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Micro Center, home to all kinds of electronics and computer items, has over 20 locations across the country, and it's also available at microcenter.com. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I live just a couple of miles away from my local Micro Center, and I've been shopping there for years. From Apple to Windows, they've got what you need. CPUs, got them. Screwdrivers and other tools, yep. Cables, televisions, scanners, projectors, cameras, they have it all. Micro Center is a place which fills your electronic needs. What are you looking for? Media centers, monitors, mice, MP3 players, media, modems, motherboards, memory? Those are just the M's. They aren't regional, but spread across our great land from Virginia to California. Each one is service and repair, in-store clinics, and business services, too. MicroCenter.com is their online store, a place where you can get your regular online ordering needs met. From the hobbyist to the professional, the brand name, or building it yourself, MicroCenter is your resource. Check out MicroCenter.com today. MicroCenter.com.
The website, ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. That's how you can reach out to us. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and we will get back with you to the answers to your computer questions, with the answers to your computer questions, as well as answering your technology concerns, whatever they may be. Keith McIntyre joins me now, and Keith, I want to just throw something at you, and I have had a lot of experience, as you have, with consulting in the IT industry for decades now. And one of the things I'm curious as to is, what was one of your most wild experiences with a client? And I'm going to give you a moment to think on that one. One of my worst experiences was having a client reach out to me. Mm-hmm. And I had been there. I had worked on one of their pieces of hardware. It was a printer. Actually, I've talked about this before. It was a printer, and they were having problems with it on the network. So I set it up on the network, and I fixed up their network problems, and I fixed the printer driver issues and a few other things.
And that really is the key to that story, Benjamin. They were having problems.
Yes. Not only were they having problems, their problems were so severe that they called me up and advised...
Wait a minute. I've known you for the better part of a decade, so I've heard this story multiple times, and I never tire hearing your story. But let's set this up for our listeners. Listeners,
go ahead.
If you've been with Computer Talk Radio for a long time, you've probably heard this story.
Yes.
But if you're new,
if you're new
to Computer Talk Radio, if you're a newer listener and you haven't heard Benjamin tell the story about the troublesome client with the printer, you are in for a treat. And Benjamin,
I want this to be for you. So the client called me up and said that they were having a problem with the printer, and I should have fixed it. I said I did fix it, and basically the response was, I need to come out and fix it again. And it was my responsibility to take care of the issue after they had already thrown it off of the second floor balcony of a portion of their house. And I'm like, wait a second here. You didn't call me when you had the new problems that you had, and now you want me to what? Fix your printer? No.
Resurrect it after you broke it and killed it?
She wanted me to actually buy her a new printer, I think. I mean, this goes back 15 years. Oh, yeah. So I know we have had various discussions over the years. I've told you this story a few times, and we keep coming back to it for whatever reason. What's the one that comes to mind for you, though, right now? What is one of the crazier experiences?
Well, there's a couple that come to mind. One, it was actually a teachable moment that actually was not really crazy so much as it was made me really put my thinking cap on, and I'll circle back to that one, because that one's actually good, thought process. But one of the crazier ones was I got this guy, and he was a crazy, crazy chain smoker. And I think he was either manic or bipolar or something,
yeah,
kind of bouncing off the walls and all over the place, disjointed with his thoughts. And I should have just left right there, because I don't go into overly smoky locations. I mean, most people don't smoke these days anymore anyway. But this guy was like a heavy chain smoker, and he was telling me stories of all kinds of weird restaurants he'd been to, and like distracting me from my work, and talk about chicken tikka masala. And I'm like, yeah, all I can smell is the smoke in this place, and this is just nasty and distracting.
Yeah.
And you're making me exceedingly uncomfortable just being here. Like, almost like kind of afraid for my life. Just I was so imbalanced. You didn't know.
Where's my phone in case I need to dial 911?
Then there was another guy, and I went to do work for him, and he was really shady, and he had these really, really, really ultra long encrypted passwords that he had to keep written down because he was afraid of anybody getting into his system. And then he would call me.
I had one of those
at like 7 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday after I'd been out there on a Friday. And because he didn't understand the way something was working, blamed me for it and left me this expletive laden voicemail telling me what I could do with the money he gave me. And, you know, because I didn't call him back at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, like within 5 minutes.
I had a similar experience. I'll tell you about that one later.
But the one that kind of sticks out to me as a teachable moment, is actually useful, was the time that I first realized that network communication can be the lowest common denominator of system performance. And this is right when people were moving from dial-up to the earliest
always-on
broadband broadband connections, and somebody would call me up, and this is on a beige Macintosh. I remember this like it was yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, swearing up and down, you know, I paid you all this money. Why is my system working? Why is it so slow? You told me you fixed everything. And I knew there was nothing at all wrong with their Mac. And the problem was their internet connection on their like 1 megabit per second broadband connection. And it was that point in time when I had to educate myself on networking as well. And again, turn of the century type of stuff. And make part of what I do interacting with the internet providers, and that became part and parcel of the services that I provide to make sure that the system's running. Mm-hmm. So that was actually beneficial to learn that, but it was stressful learning it at the onset.
Yeah, I had a number of different occasions where I did have learning experiences. I think we all do in IT, and this is part of life for everyone. We all experience those learning experiences, and we become better for it.
I agree.
And I would just ask for everybody dealing with IT workers that you understand that sometimes we do discover these things along the way when we're dealing with, of all people, you. Sorry, it just happens. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell.
And I'm Keith M. Cedor.
You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Most of us use digital cameras nowadays, but what do we do with those old pictures and slides in the back of the closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. If you have boxes of old slides, then you know they fade more and more each year. Let Legacy Digital scan them for you and stop the aging process dead in its tracks. You'll get beautiful 10-megapixel digital files, color-corrected and ready for printing. All this is done faster and cheaper than buying a film scanner and doing it yourself. Your files are then burned onto gold archival DVD discs where they will last for generations. Call right now, mention my name, Benjamin Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY. And tell them Benjamin sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
Phone number 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. Marty Winston joins me now, and we are currently on a Skype meeting. Yeah, we're using Skype. I had to double check. And it's kind of funny that we're talking about that because you've got a bunch of stats that you've been gathering.
I've been doing a lot of homework about meetings, and I was amazed to find 2 years, 2023 and 2024, reports from Microsoft called Work Trend Index Annual Report, for example. In the most recent one, and it's not all about meetings. Most of it reads like a Medicare Advantage commercial for AI.
So,
I went in and plucked some gems from 2024, for example, and I quote, meetings and after-hours work are holding steady at their post-pandemic highs, haven't reduced, and the workday still skews toward communication. In the Microsoft 365 apps, users spend 60% of their time on emails, chats, and meetings, and only 40% in creation apps.
Okay. I would say that feels true to me. that's a lot of my experience.
Yeah, but it's a lot less time to be creative, and sometimes creative's more fulfilling.
Sure.
From 2023, with a balance of work hours spent communicating, 68% of people say they don't have enough uninterrupted focus time during the workday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We set aside where I work right now. We are setting aside roughly, The Friday afternoons for focusing. No meetings are allowed there. And there are a few other scattered times throughout the week and the month that vary, where they say, nope, no meetings here, no meetings there. I actually do work instead of talking to everybody.
I love taboos.
So that's usually when we do the water cooler gossip. And I'm totally kidding. I couldn't resist, though.
People report that the number one productivity disruptor is inefficient meetings, followed closely by having too many meetings at number three. Okay. Most people say it's difficult to brainstorm in a virtual meeting, that's 58%, or catch up if they joined a meeting late, that's 57%.
Okay.
And that next steps at the end of a meeting are unclear, 55%, and that it's hard to summarize what happens, 56%. And since February 2020, people are in three times more Teams meetings and calls per week, 192% more. The data shows a clear need to make meetings better.
And I'm thinking through some of those numbers. So brainstorming, I'd agree with that one. If I'm late to a meeting, I do struggle with some of the catching up. Depending on what the meeting's for, some of it's pretty wild. Let's see here. Next steps. I think we're pretty good there where I'm at. Summarizing, we do have a problem. We're chasing after an AI solution to listen to the meeting and summarize it up for us. And it's interesting.
A summary of rotten content is still a rotten summary.
Oh, dear.
Let's try this one. Today, only one in three people, 35%, think they would be missed in the majority of their meetings.
I lead over half of the meetings that I'm in.
Did you bring too many people to the table?
I try to be careful about how many people I invite. Sometimes I just can't avoid it, though.
And for everyone else in your company, for the meetings they have, are they just as careful?
No. Being brutally honest, nobody knows where I work, so I think I'm safe with saying that one.
Yeah. Careless is contagious.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Now, this next important concept is a long item, so here we go. We're all carrying digital debt. The inflow of data, emails, meetings, and notifications has outpaced humans' ability to process it all. And the pace of work is only intensifying. Everything feels important, so we spend our workdays trying to get out of the red. Nearly two in three people, 64%, say they struggle with having the time and energy to do their job. And those people are 3.5 times more likely to also struggle with innovation and strategic thinking. And nearly two in three leaders, 60%, are already feeling the effects, saying that a lack of innovation or breakthrough ideas on their teams is a concern. There are only so many minutes in the day, and every minute we spend managing the digital debt is a minute not spent on the creative work that leads to innovation. In a world where creativity is the new productivity, digital debt is more than an inconvenience. It's impacting business.
That is, I would definitely say that,
Let me hit these last three all at once. The heaviest meeting users, top 25%, spend 7.5 hours a week in meetings. The data reveals an urgent need to make meetings more effective. People report inefficient meetings as their number one productivity disruptor, and only 35% of people say they would be missed by colleagues in a majority of their meetings if they couldn't join.
Wow. There's a lot of resistance to the meetings. As I'm listening here, there's a lot of people who are feeling discouraged, I'm sure, about meetings.
We've got to find a way to fix this.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. This is a problem that is only going to get worse until we start fixing it. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and just a normal person. Recently, though, it was clear to me that it was time to upgrade. But I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After searching around for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when a 32-ounce soda would do. These guys know WordPress, Joomla, and regular standard websites. These guys at SiteGround are awesome. SiteGround.com. Site, S-I-T-E, ground.com. The bad guys are out to get us. They're out to get you, me, everybody they can. The tricks that they have are just numerous, voluminous. I didn't say that word right, but you've got the idea. There's just tons of different things they do. One of the ones that is building up again, it's been around for ages. We have seen this here at Computer Talk Radio. I've seen this personally since early text messages, back before the iPhone, back before Android phones, back in the old days. And it's something you want to be aware of. Now, there are two parts to any scam. The first part is opening up the conversation. The second part is leveraging whatever conversation, whatever rapport that they've built up into the scam. We want to avoid even getting to part two. We want to deal with this at part one. So one of the things that we've seen, again, popular for years, is you get a text message and it goes, "I've changed my number." And this is all part of this setup here. And it can go in a number of different ways, but it basically starts off with, "I've changed my number." Okay, I'm looking at the text message. I don't know who you are. You've told me you've changed your number. You haven't even associated a name with this. So they may respond. If you go back to them and you say, "Who are you?" Well, then they'll say, "Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I totally forgot. Oh, this is John Doe." I don't know a John Doe. I don't know any John Does. Can you clarify? No, they are starting to engage you in a conversation. And the further you go through this conversation, the further they have their tentacles into you and your life and so forth. So you want to avoid all of that. You never want to respond to any of these blank ones that have no name associated with it or anything like that. But let's even forget about that part. "Hey, this is John Smith. I've changed my number." That is another variation on this, because they're pretending to be somebody you know. You may know a John Smith, and you may say, "Okay, well, John, hey, a long time no talk. It's been a while." And the next thing they're going to say is, "Oh, yeah, don't contact me at my old number. It's disconnected. So, just reach out to me here and we'll communicate here." And then they go into a number of different things. They look to leverage that connection, that whole setup that they've already completed in convincing you that they are John Smith. And we have a tendency to think about these text messages, and we develop these short reports, and then they can leverage this a matter of immediately, or sometimes weeks later, months later. "Hey, you know what? I'm short on cash. Can you Venmo me $50 at whatever, at XYZ123? "Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that John Smith had that as his Venmo. I would have expected something better out of him." The reality is, they're looking to establish that. No, you want to reach out to John Smith through whatever other methods you've got to validate that this is truly John Smith's new number. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about The Radio Factory, an exciting new venue for talk radio. It's the internet, the wave of the present. My name is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm the host of a syndicated radio program, Computer Talk Radio. So I know the internet is here and now. Many of the hosts at theradiofactory.com have their own podcasts or radio shows across the country. But many people like the comfort of listening to their own special radio show at a specific time and day, much like we watch live television. The internet, as you're probably aware, is a powerful tool that allows the Radio Factory to deliver unique programming with far more variety than the windbags who are simply about contriving up viewpoints to get you riled up. Additionally, you'll find that many of the programs are shorter, giving more information in less time. Stick with theradiofactory.com and see how it evolves to keep you entertained, interested, informed, and above all, intelligent. After all, the Radio Factory motto is building your intelligence one talk show at a time. Theradiofactory.com.
Hard drives, broadband routers, keyboards, and mice, but he still has those nerdy glasses. Bringing you the latest in computers and gadgetry, here's Benjamin Rockwell with Computer Talk Radio.
We are halfway through this week's Computer Talk Radio. If you have questions for us, you've got comments, concerns, whatever they may be, feel free to reach out to us at the website, computertalkradio.com. We make it really easy. That's the name of the show, Computer Talk Radio, and then you just throw .com at the end. Of course, if you've got computer questions, you can reach out there, or you can phone me at 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. We are radio's broadest look at computers, technology, and how they impact all of us. And we're more than excited to answer your computer questions. Steve Keske joins me now. And Steve, what do you have for us this week?
Well, I was listening to a documentary, and they were talking about World War II and radar.
Okay, yes.
And very specific. You know, we all understand because we talk about history and everybody's talking about Bensley Park in England, and, and they talk about Los Alamos and the atomic bomb. But very few people know that America and England's primary development of radars was done at MIT.
Interesting. I didn't know it was MIT, but yeah, okay.
And by the time the end of the war, they had over 4,000 men and women working on radar.
So a very interesting thing. And this is a story that comes from my family. And so I heard about this particular story way back in the early 80s. And my grandfather told me that his father not only worked on radar, but he also helped put in the radar installation at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Specifically, there were, and I'm doing this from memory, I believe there were 7 installations across the northern side of the island.
Right.
And now at that time, everybody said, no, we didn't have radar then. We didn't have radar then. And it wasn't until the early 90s when it came out, oh yeah, we did have radar out there at Hawaii. We saw the airplanes coming in, and there's a lot of apocryphal stories. We can't really prove out that, yeah, we saw them coming in, and we were told to step down, or we saw them coming in, but we couldn't figure it out. We thought it was a problem with the radar, and you know, the variety of stories that come along with that. It doesn't matter, but yeah.
The one I've heard the most is saying, oh yeah, we saw the airplanes coming in, and we notified the upper echelon, and upper echelon said no.
yeah,
there's just forget it.
Yeah, a lot of different ways that unfolded, but the fact that they sat on that for
a long time.
We'll say roughly 50 years before revealing it out, says whatever story it is, it isn't a good one.
No.
Which is unfortunate. But, you know, that frequently happens. You know, we're talking military secrets or what used to be military secrets. I mean, someday we may find out who shot JFK.
Yeah.
Depending on, you know, whatever theory you've got going there. And that's, of course, another story for another show. That's not even us. It has nothing to do with computers and technology, but radar. So MIT, I'm sorry, I took you on a wild tangent there. MIT.
No run tangent with it. There at all. Anyway, this particular documenter was explaining how the Germans and the Allies were actually in competition to see who could come up with the newest innovation. And of course, MIT said, "Oh, we can do this pretty good." And they did, and they kept ahead of the Germans. See, at the beginning of the war, the Germans didn't even realize that radar was devastating their aircraft coming over to England. But all of a sudden, okay, now they understood. It was MIT with came up with the first radar, and they put it in a B-17.
Okay.
Now, that portable radar unit.
Yeah, yeah.
And what they'd only do is put it in the first lead airplane.
Okay, yeah.
So when the lead airplane got over the target, and they knew they were over the target because they could see through clouds and rain and whatever.
Yeah.
And they dropped their bombs, and everybody else would start dropping theirs, you know, and head for home. But that was one of the innovations using, well, when the Germans decided, they said, well, we can jam that. Well, guess what, guys? We came out with a shortwave microwave radar. Say what? Well, they couldn't jam it because it was just short. You know, the wavelength was a lot shorter. And all that kind of stuff, the innovations. It was MIT's people that came up with the whole idea of putting the radar in aircraft that were going out there and searching for submarines, because the submarines had to come to the surface for oxygen.
Yeah, okay, yeah. That was quite a big thing back then. Yeah. They needed air. Who figured? Yeah, no, they knew that for a while. But unlike today's submarines, which can stay submerged for months on end, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, they're sitting there and they're going, yeah, well, the minute they surface, we could see them on radar. Hey, you got a good radar. Bingo, you got the guy before. And that started the whole decline of the U-boats in the North Atlantic. Those type of things. And they went through a lot of the innovations and the whole idea of this going through and doing all of the ramifications of keeping ahead of the Germans. You know, for that, and the same thing held true with radar when it came to the Pacific. We were using radars that were highly sophisticated to, you know, concerning, you know, all the airplanes and ships and everything, and the Japanese couldn't figure out how.
I do know that once Pearl Harbor happened, they went to fully manning, full round-the-clock operation on every radar installation that was created, and came up with many more radar installations over the course of the coming years.
Yeah, and one of the innovations post World War II,
yeah,
was SAGE.
SAGE, okay.
Well, we call it NORAD, but
oh, okay. What did SAGE stand for?
I couldn't remember.
Okay,
but anyway, it was that whole idea of putting a string of radar sites all the way across North America,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, they did that, and all the way from Alaska, all the way across to Newfoundland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it's still working today.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it doesn't NORAD have more of a range than then? Doesn't it extend to Europe and all of that? Even though it really is supposed to be North American Aerospace Defense Command.
Yeah.
Or maybe is that a question I shouldn't ask?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
It extends because NORAD works hand in hand with all the
other locations. Yes. Other locations. All right.
And they have what are considered the most revolutionary radars, which is called Over the Horizon.
Yes. Yeah.
How somebody figured that one out is beyond me, but
yeah,
it still works.
Oh yeah, we could go on for quite a while on all of the different arrows, and actually, you do this a bit. You bring in a lot of your past history and experience in the military, which we definitely appreciate here, because the military is home to origination of many of the different technologies we deal with today and will in the coming future.
Yep.
As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Steve Keske. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. You have a couple of those new carbon open frame racks from CyberPower, right?
Yeah, I love them. I configured a 25U to 40 inches deep, about twice as deep as a regular rack, and put more than a dozen peripherals in it.
You know, I saw your article about it. I can't believe it's not clutter.
And my 45U carbon rack, that's also 40 inches deep, will hold a ton of networking and control systems, the network video recorder.
Holy screwdriver, rack man!
You're getting one of their gorgeous enclosed racks soon.
Oh yeah, the 24U. Bigger than their wall mount carbon racks, but smaller than their tall boy.
Did you see what's happening with carbon on the CyberPower website?
Oh yeah, the promo, 10% off all their racks and rack accessories through the end of September. I put a link up at computertalkradio.com. computertalkradio.com. Danielle reached out to me at 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. She wanted to understand this thing she'd heard about on the news and in other places about the technological singularity. What is it all about? Is it really going to happen and things like that? All right. So let's piece this apart. Let's talk about what it is. We can think of the singularity like a rocket launch. Right now, technology is climbing. It's steadily climbing, but that singularity represents a point where the rocket's speed becomes exponential. It goes so fast, it climbs so fast, and it doesn't have any resistance as it's moving up through our atmosphere and off into space, so that it transforms so fast that life as we know it changes completely. This is a concept rooted in both fascination and fear, and understanding it can really help us figure out what's going to lie ahead. What is it? So Arthur C. Clarke, he had a short story back a few decades ago, Dial F for Frankenstein, and it's where the phone system all of the switches, all of the different pieces of the phone system rang all the phones in the world at the same time. It was the start of the building of a logic-based brain, not unlike the synapses of our own brain. The ensuing chaos in this story, as the brain tried to understand our world and control it, was the stuff of nightmares that led to many different scary movies. It's part of a hypothetical future moment when artificial intelligence surpasses human intelligence, and it leads to this level of runaway advancements in technology. At this point, machines, the machine, might start designing even more machines, smarter machines, which creates this feedback loop of rapid progress in the thinking of that technological singularity. What are the key characteristics of this? Well, it's machines developing independent problem-solving capabilities, and then a merging of human and machine intelligence. I want you to think of like those brain-computer interfaces, like what Elon Musk is chasing after, that Neuralink. And then everything just accelerates, not only beyond our comprehension. All of this technological process will go forward without even our control, our human control. Now, is this actually going to happen? So there are opinions out there. There's a number of them, and there are various experts that have come out of the woodwork, and they've said, oh, yeah, it can happen. It may happen off in the future. Ray Kurzweil, he's a big name. He's a futurist that's been talking on a variety of different technology things for a long time now. And he believes it could happen as early as 2045. There are others that are skeptical. They cite that we are going to have technical hurdles. We're going to have ethical hurdles. We're going to have a number of different things that we're going to have to set in place, the proverbial reaching on over and unplugging the power that will actually allow us to control if this is going to actually happen. And I think about this every once in a while when people bring this up. And there are a lot of things that really are challenges in the way of this happening. There's the idea of the current challenges of AI. We go forward with, we play around with artificial intelligence, or what has been deemed as such. And it's far, I've said this many times, Marty's said this, Keith too. It's artificial. It's far more artificial than it is intelligence. It struggles with creativity, with reasoning, with context. We can go and we can go on to ChatGPT or any of these large language models, and we can type in stuff, and it looks like it's got more brains than we do. But no, it actually just has far more instant access to a lot of information around the world, and it can assemble this into terms we can understand. It breaks down all of the different languages. Even though a lot of it may be in English, it breaks it all down and it tries to bring it to information on our level, which is fine, but it is a very purpose-built machine to gather information, fold, spindle, mutilate it, to reprocess it and deliver it to us in easy-to-understand concerns. There are other things along the way that we are going to need to address with AI before it even starts to move to that next level. First off, accuracy. Accuracy is, it's still very low. Yes, it can be very accurate on certain smaller items, but the bigger items, the bigger concepts, it struggles with. It even struggles with the idea of if it is sentient, and it's not. So we have other concerns along the way. Bias. There's a ton of bias. There's a ton of different things that are just, it's struggling with. AI is not all that it's cracked up to be. It exists, and it feels like it has more knowledge than we do, but it's just gathering that information and translating it, and it's really still quite dumb. We have, of course, a societal readiness that we're not prepared for, and I think we're going to, along the way, keep a good level of control on this. We're not prepared for jobs, governance, and daily world in a daily life, in this world that would be dominated by any kind of AI. So, yeah, I mean, if it does happen, we may see some very interesting things out of it, some positives like cures for disease and ending scarcity and things like that. But we struggle with that with when we get together 100 of some of the smartest people in the world, thousands of these, and we still struggle. There are negatives if it does occur eventually. There would be a loss of control over many portions of our lives and a lot of different decisions that would be made without us. And there's going to be ethical dilemmas. There's going to be existential dilemmas if AI priorities conflict with our own priorities as a human race. But I think so much of this is based in horror stories versus reality. I don't foresee this ever coming to fruition. I don't think this is going to come through like people think it will. Why? Because the ability for AI to reach that level is so far off. And the best way to explain this, the best way to explain that this is all farther away than we might even fathom is that our own brains, your brain, my brain, everybody's individual brains out there have about a quadrillion switches. We call them neurons and synapses. This is all of the different bits and pieces within our brain that help us to think, that help us to be self-aware and to process and to build and to experience art and music in all of these different ways. Our brains have a quadrillion switches. That is more than all of the logic connections currently in the world. And when I'm talking about logic connections, I'm talking about all of the different networks and switches, but all of the different computers, all of these different computers that are not even touching each other. The idea of a tech singularity to me is more of a concept that I feel is born out of horror stories and is not really a potential reality for many decades to come. Whether or not we reach it, exploring this concept helps us prepare for a future that could be shaped by technology. By focusing on the ethical AI development and understanding its implications, we can steer towards a far brighter outcome rather than a chaotic one. And I don't think either of those is actually going to arrive anytime soon. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Micro Center, home to all kinds of electronics and computer items, has over 20 locations across the country, and it's also available at microcenter.com. This is Benjamin Rockwell of Computer Talk Radio, and I live just a couple of miles away from my local Micro Center, and I've been shopping there for years. From Apple to Windows, they've got what you need. CPUs, got them. Screwdrivers and other tools, yep. Cables, televisions, scanners, projectors, cameras, they have it all. Micro Center is a place which fills your electronic needs. What are you looking for? Media centers, monitors, mice, MP3 players, media, modems, motherboards, memory? Those are just the M's. They aren't regional, but spread across our great land from Virginia to California. Each one is service and repair, in-store clinics, and business services, too. MicroCenter.com is their online store, a place where you can get your regular online ordering needs met. From the hobbyist to the professional, the brand name, or building it yourself, MicroCenter is your resource. Check out MicroCenter.com today. MicroCenter.com.
Sarah reached out to me. You can do it too. You can reach out to me at computertalkradio.com, computertalkradio.com. Scroll down to where it says contact us today, and I will get back to you with your computer questions and your technology concerns. Sarah's question, how do we reconcile advancements in artificial intelligence with the belief that humans are uniquely created in the image of God? All right, so, wow, this is a lot to unpack, and I'm going to try and do that in the next, we've got about a little bit more than 7 minutes left here in this segment. So let's talk about this from the idea that artificial intelligence is far more, we'll start off with that. Artificial intelligence is far more artificial than it is intelligent. And it is going to progress from here. It is going to improve as we move along the way through all of the different aspects of the different reaches of artificial intelligence. And so the development of this and balancing it with the Christian view of humanity's unique value is along this. While a tool can create incredible results, while AI can create amazing things, it never actually replaces the artist's creative spark. Everything we've got with AI is going to still have to be driven by us deciding what we're creating and asking AI to assist us with creating that. AI must remain and will likely remain a servant to us as individuals, us as workers, us as humanity. And we are simply utilizing a tool. And I want you to step back, and I want you to think about this quote that came from Arthur C. Clarke many years ago. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And we look at artificial intelligence. We look at how we can ask just a couple of sentences worth of information. We can ask this of AI, and it provides us with an amazing response. And we can ask it to create an image for us based on, oh, give me a cat wearing a spacesuit that is walking up to the space shuttle or whatever it is that we want. And it will make that. And we go, wow, that's amazing. That is absolutely wonderful. And we forget that all it is doing is it's operating through algorithms. Algorithms that were written by many different computer programmers. And yes, we go along and we keep doing this, and we may even have AI help us with the code, but it's still us building up that code as people. And we keep going along through this. AI, no matter how advanced it's likely to get for the foreseeable future, is a tool. It lacks any of the things that we think of that would lend towards being anything more than a false impression of humanity. It has no consciousness. It has no morality. It has no intrinsic worth. It is simply a tool that we are going through and we are using. And it is limited, and it is easily led astray, and it easily will, instead of putting up that picture of a cat, it might put a dog there. Well, it's probably not going to put a dog, but it may get confused along the way, and it may not provide us with exactly the right image that we have in our own mind. It has all of these different limitations along the way. We need to continue to highlight human creativity throughout all of this. We need to be emphasizing all of the human qualities that we have that AI cannot replicate. You can be creative. AI can't be creative. You can have empathy, and you can help drive those empathetic ideas in people by the pictures that you are taking. Think of all of the pictures in the past that you've seen, and you have empathy for whatever is going on in that picture. Well, AI can't drive that. They can give images that maybe resemble some of that stuff that we've seen in all of these photographs over the years, but they can't drive the emotional portion of our hearts quite the same way as a real image. And of course, I've already kind of indicated this. There is no moral reasoning that AI can put into anything. You can ask for it to give you any kind of a description of morality or moral subjects or whatever. And all it's going to do is it's going to regurgitate what it's studied and read on the internet from various other locations all around and just assemble it in what sounds like a good direction to go in. It's going to lack any of the tried and true that we might see in something like the Bible. So we have to think about AI very carefully. Now, we can use this. We can use AI, but we need to be thinking about the purpose that we're using AI for. And we need to be using AI to serve people, to uplift them. We need to move away from mimicking or replacing humanity. And that is something that we need to be ensuring that we're putting stoppers in place to make sure that it doesn't wind up being something that we put so much energy and so much effort into it that we lose a portion of ourselves. Just as a tool cannot replace the vision of the artist, AI should complement our divine purpose without challenging our sacred uniqueness in the universe. That's kind of my approach to it. Benjamin Rockwell, the host here at Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Benjamin is always ready to answer your questions. You may submit your questions online using the contact form at the Computer Talk Radio website, computertalkradio.com.
Hey guys, this is Benny Rockwell. Most of us use video cameras nowadays, but what about those old movie films in the back of your closet? Well, let me tell you about Legacy Digital Productions. They specialize in taking your old memories on film, videotape, and slides and digitizing them to DVDs. Imagine Grandpa's old 8mm and 16mm films that are just sitting in a box getting old and fading away. Legacy Digital will clean and recondition those films, capture them digitally frame by frame, and then produce beautiful DVDs of your precious memories on long-lasting archive-quality discs. They don't use a projector, and your films can't be damaged in the process, the best available for families like yours. The final results are gorgeous. What better way to preserve those precious memories for future generations? Call right now, mention my name, Benny Rockwell, and receive a 30% discount on your order. Call toll-free 1-866-2-LEGACY. That's 1-866-2-LEGACY, 1-866-253-4229. And tell them Benny sent you. Your memories are priceless, so call 866-2-LEGACY now.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, IT professionals, and a number of different related items all the way throughout that. I'm in the middle of a short series in regards to burnout, and last week I talked about the whole experience that I had with burning out. I was in my late 20s, and I worked for a company. I was putting in roughly 90 hours a week, maybe a little bit more at times, definitely never less than 80. And yeah, it was a rough time. And I want to talk this week on a couple of different things in regards to this. Let's first off talk about why are IT professionals at a higher risk of burnout. There is this expectation of constant availability throughout the industry, especially in smaller companies. When we start talking about under 10 people in IT, there's a lot of different things that can go wrong, especially in different areas where the the hands that have been involved with putting together this technology department, the all of the different servers, the routers, the different switches, all of the different pieces of computers and printers and everything else, all of these different things. And if we have multiple people along the way specifying this, and there's a person in that job for a year or two, and they go in one direction, and another person comes along and they go in a different direction, all of this different piecemeal technology department that has been put together is hard to troubleshoot. It takes a lot of effort to put together what is going wrong with this item. Oh, that's what we would expect if it were X brand, but this is Y brand. Okay, so what about Y brand? What happens here? So there's a lot of things like that. Then we move into the very tight deadlines, and there's all of this chasing forward. We move forward with technology in all companies because technology is seen as just an amazing thing here. This is how we're going to set ourselves apart from the other companies that are out there. Well, when you do that, there's a lot of this chasing forward. There's a lot of disconnect in upper management in a number of different companies about how long it takes to do certain projects. Oh, you should be able to put that together in a matter of a week or two. No, what you just described is a 6-month project if I work on it full time. Well, can you get it done in 2 months? No, it's a 6-month project if I do it full time. If you need it done faster than that, you still can't throw 7 people at it and get it done in a 2-month time period, because some of this is very linear. We have to do A, then B, then C, then D, and all of that. And a lot of these projects wind up being very high stakes projects. This is how we're going to set the company going forward. This is how we're going to make sure that the company is going to survive. This is so important, and we're putting all of our energy into this. And of course, all of the IT people have to put all of their energy into this. And then we get into the issue of there's a lot of different technology evolutions that are happening. And we think of technology overall as evolving, but the reality is every single piece of technology throughout our companies is evolving. Whether we're talking about desktops moving from Windows 10 to Windows 11, we talk about the servers moving up through the various generations of servers. We have to update all of the switches. We have to, again, all of this hardware, all of this software, and everything that fits into this. If you think about it, how many programs do you rely on your computer every day? Now, think about this, because some of those programs are located locally. Some of those are software as a service, meaning you're going to a website, not to a program on your local system, but it's a website that hosts a software program, and you're going to that, and you have to keep that updated. So there's a lot of different things that are coming along through all of that, and it just keeps evolving each of them individually, and those all have to be checked and updated, and they have to be tested before you update them, and then they have to be validated after that. And then there's the additional support, because everything has changed and everybody has questions. And then along with this, IT professionals, because of all of these different things that are just going on, there's a limited amount of opportunity for unplugging due to the nature of all of the interrelationship of the hardware and software throughout. And you have to keep pace with all of this. You have to keep learning. So there's a lot of pressure that's going on through all of this. IT professionals, if I were going to say anything to anybody getting in the industry, I would tell them that they have to be very aware that this is not your typical 9-to-5 job. This is not a simple, you walk in the morning, you work a few hours, you work through, you take a lunch, then you work a few more hours, and then you go home at the end of the day. I can't tell you how many times I've been awoken in the middle of the night with just news of something that this particular thing happened and we're in trouble and we need to fix this before people start arriving in the morning. Yeah, there's a reason why IT professionals are at a higher risk for burnout, and it's not recognized by a lot of people. It's not really even accepted. There's a lot of different pressure upon IT people. Okay, you can get a few hours off tomorrow because you worked all day and all night and all day again today. And, you know, come in a couple hours late tomorrow. Well, why not? As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment. Years ago, I found a web hosting company that fit my needs as a computer nerd, as a radio show host, and, well, a normal person. Recently, though, it became clear to me that it was time to upgrade. I had a choice between my old plan and the new one at 7 times the cost. It was that awkward point where I could choose between a sip of water or being dunked in a pool. I searched around, comparing the many options for someone like me. After looking for 3 weeks, there it was, SiteGround. In proper fashion, I tested their customer service, their knowledge, and their care, their willingness to do things the right way. The SiteGround salesman made sure that I didn't overbuy and get a 50-gallon bucket when all I needed was a 1-gallon bucket. The folks at SiteGround know WordPress, Joomla, and more. SiteGround.com, S-I-T-E, ground.com for your web hosting needs. SiteGround. Sam reached out to me at 888-NERD-888. That's 888-637-3888. Sam's question was in regards to this concept of subs for subs or sub for sub. I've heard it both ways. And the idea of this is on any of the social media platforms that you follow someone, and in return, they will follow you. And that's all of these different people gathering together, and they're just following each other in the hopes of bumping up the amount of subscribers to their particular channel, if you will. We'll focus on YouTube for this, but it applies across all of these different platforms. And he said, does it work? And the answer to that is pretty simple. Sure, you might get a little bit of a bump here and there, but the reality is you're not going to get the type of bump that you want. You're not going to get the amount of true subscribers, but you're not even going to increase the amount of real views to your various content on there. The people who are following each other in this kind of concept, they are looking for simply building up their own subscribers without focusing on building up the amount of viewers. And all of these different platforms push the popular content. So you need to go through, everybody who is dealing with this, they need to be working on something that is going to build organically. A matter of building up all of the different viewership through both quantity of content, but also quality of content. And that is how you build up your viewership. That's how you really start to move through to the next level. If you have content up there that is really boring, it is really just, it sits there and it doesn't sound good, it doesn't look good, it's not interesting, people are going to move on. People are just going to check out. And that is going to be something that is also tracked by all of the different algorithms. Okay, everybody looked at this video for a matter of a minute that looked at it. Well, it's a 20-minute video. Do we really want to push people to this? Because according to the algorithm, People are getting a minute in and they're just shuffling on. You want to build up your brand that way. Now, the other thing to remember is that there are a lot of different professional marketers out there. There's a lot of different people who are going through and they're doing a number of different things. You may see people posting various video content, various different information that they've put up there, but they're doing it very, very professionally. But they also have a team that's working with them behind the scenes. My best suggestion for everyone is work on building up your content how you like it, building up, again, quantity and quality, and then don't worry about the rest. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Let me tell you about The Radio Factory, an exciting new venue for talk radio. It's the internet, the wave of the present. My name is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm the host of a syndicated radio program, Computer Talk Radio, so I know the internet is here and now. Many of the hosts at theradiofactory.com have their own podcasts or radio shows across the country, but many people like the comfort of listening to their own special radio show at a specific time and day, much like we watch live television. The internet, as you're probably aware, is a powerful tool that allows The Radio Factory to deliver unique programming with far more variety than the windbags who are simply about contriving up viewpoints to get you riled up. Additionally, you'll find that many of the programs are shorter, giving more information in less time. Stick with theradiofactory.com and see how it evolves to keep you entertained, interested, informed, and above all, intelligent. After all, the Radio Factory motto is building your intelligence one talk show at a time. Theradiofactory.com.